Good afternoon, everyone. Kind of fooled you trying to decide who was. Will the real sermonette speaker stand up, please? Solly and his father and his older brother Dave worked in a business in Upper Manhattan in New York. It was basically import-export shipping and trucking that his father had built from scratch after immigrating to the U.S. Solly was a little bit of a playboy. He wasn't that interested in the business, and occasionally he'd borrow his father's Learjet and fly to Paris with his stunning girlfriend for a walk along the Champs-Élysées and a midnight cruise on the River Seine. At some point, he finally decided he'd ask his father if he could have his inheritance, because he said, "Dad, you know, I'm not really that interested in the business." And his father knew that and was a little reluctant to advance him his inheritance, but he thought, well, why not? He's a little bit of an entrepreneur. Maybe he'll do something. So he said, "It'll take me a couple of weeks. I have to liquidate some of my real estate holdings, and it'll take, you know, a little time to come up with the money." But in 2 weeks, he handed him a certified check for $8 million. And Solly took it down, deposited it to his bank account, set up a line of credit, and he thought it was getting kind of cold in New York. He'd fly to L.A. and have a little bit of fun before he settled down and got serious about a business. So he flew out there, he rented a deluxe penthouse apartment, leased a Jaguar, and spent his time going to the beach during the day, and he started hitting the nightclubs at night. And gradually, the days passed into weeks, and the weeks passed into months. And he just showed no sign of starting his business. And finally, one day his accountant called and said, "You know, your funds are not going to last much longer. Your checks are going to start bouncing pretty soon." But he was having such a good time, he thought, he didn't worry about it. Until a month later, when he found all of his personal belongings out on the street, and they came and repossessed his Jaguar. And so he was forced to sell all his personal belongings and had enough from the sale of them to rent a cheap hotel on the West Side for about a month. But when that month came to an end, he didn't have any place to go. He didn't have any money for food or haircut or anything like that, so his hair started to grow long and his beard started to grow out. He started hanging out with the street people, panhandling, going from place to place. And it started to get colder. And after a month or so of this, he decided, you know, I think I'll go back and see if I can go back to work for my dad. This is no way to live. So he hitchhiked across the country from LA to New York, and it took a little while, but he got a couple of friendly truckers to give him a lift. But when he got back to New York, he was so embarrassed he didn't want to face his father. And so he moved around from Brooklyn to the Bronx to Queens, to the homeless shelters for a while, until one night in late November, he was standing around a barrel with some other homeless people, rubbing his hands, trying to keep warm. And just that day, he had seen one of his father's employees. He didn't recognize him now because his beard was long and covered his face. His hair was hanging down and scraggly. He was gaunt and skinny. He'd lost about 30 pounds, and his clothes just barely hung on him. And he thought to himself, you know, he doesn't earn a lot, I know that, but he's well-dressed, he has food, he's got a place to go, a home. He says, I'm gonna go see my dad tomorrow. So the next morning, he went and knocked on the door of his father's mansion. And when the butler opened the door and saw him, he was about ready to slam it in his face because he didn't recognize this apparition that stood in front of him. But he said, "James, don't close the door. How is your wife Bertha doing? And how are your daughters Sally and Sabrina? Are they still going to Dartmouth?" And James thought a minute and thought, well, he must know me. I mean, he wouldn't know this kind of type of personal information. So he looked more closely. He said, "Solly, is that you?" And he said, "Yes." So he said, "Well, come on in." And he picked up the phone there and called his dad, who happened to be home, and said, "Solly's back." And his dad said, "Call the cook, have him order the best Chateaubriand that there is. you call the musicians union and hire a combo and have them come in and then call all of our family and friends. We're going to have a celebration. And he rushed down and ran to his son and just threw his arms around him. In spite of the fact that he smelled, it didn't make any difference to his father. So anyway, all of this starts taking place. Now, Dave was out that afternoon with a client and didn't get the message until that night he came home. So all these cars lined up along his father's in front of the house, and heard the music coming from inside, and he walked up and asked James, what's going on? And he said, well, didn't you hear your brother Dave is back? And at this point, in case you haven't noticed, this is a 21st century version of the prodigal son, as it might have happened at this time in our lives today. And let's go to Luke 15, where this is found, the account of this is found, because I want to pick it up here briefly to see what happened when the older brother got home. In Luke 15, verse 28, and he was angry. His older brother was angry that his younger brother had come home. He was resentful. And he goes on to tell why. He wouldn't go in, so his father came out and tried to talk him into coming in. And he, answering his father in verse 29, says, you know, I've worked for you all of these years. I've done everything that you wanted me to do. It didn't make any difference. I played by the rules. I didn't try to talk you out of doing it a different way. I was very obedient. And yet you never gave me any kind of a celebration. I've worked faithfully for you. And yet when your son comes home, verse 30, who's spent an $8 million inheritance on nightclubbing and loose women, and what do? You call everyone and have a celebration. And then you know the rest of the story, where he talks about the forgiveness, that he was so happy to see his son home. His son had come home, and that's why he was celebrating. And this is typical of God's approach and God's concern with anyone in his family who's sinned. If they repent, he will forgive them and take them back. But I want to continue and tell you, as Paul Harvey would say, the rest of this story in the 21st century version, if we continue on from this point. It's not in the Bible, but you can kind of imagine and visualize the scenario, I think. So 3 or 4 days go by, and all of the festivities are, you know, settling down. Things go back to normal. And so Dave, the older brother, gets together with his dad and says, now, what are we going to do about Solly? Now, Dave is still resentful because he got a double portion of his father's inheritance, or $16 million, and he is running the business jointly with his father, and he's not about to let his younger brother get his hands on any of that money, because he still resents what he did. So he said, you know, we obviously, since he's fiscally irresponsible, he's not capable of managing money, he's got to start at the bottom. And his father agreed to it, so he said, there's an opening out in the hangar where his Learjet was. So Solly's out there wiping down the plane that he used to fly to Paris in. He's sweeping the hangar, and he's helping maintain the fleet of cars and trucks in the adjoining garage. That's what he's doing. And every once in a while, you hear some of the other employees laughing at him behind his back, because they're saying, well, he got his comeuppance, didn't he? And the point that I'm trying to make here is that yes, God absolutely forgives sins when we repent of them, but God doesn't necessarily remove the consequences of those sins, and there are consequences. In some cases, maybe he does, but in other cases, and in most of the cases, I believe that he allows the consequences to follow the person, because sometimes it's those consequences that drill home whatever lesson needed to be learned. And it's only because of those consequences that someone finally gets it. They finally get the message as to what they should have done in that situation. For example, you've been out drinking. You've had too much. You're driving home. Your vision's a little impaired. Your reaction time is slow. The light at the intersection changes all of a sudden, and you're into the intersection. You T-bone a car with a family in it and kill two younger children. Will God forgive you of that? Absolutely, if you repent. But the knowledge of what you've done and how you've deprived a family of those children for the rest of your life may haunt you. You may have nightmares. And the King County prosecuting attorney is not going to take it lightly, even if he knows you've repented. And I don't think that the two counts of negligent homicide that he's filed against you are going to go away. There are consequences to what you do, even if you're forgiven. What about the young teenage couple who get carried away in the back seat of a car, and 9 months later, a new life comes into being? Just getting ready to go to college, just getting ready to start a career, they may repent of what's happened, but that doesn't negate the fact there is another person that needs to be taken care of. And so hopes of going to college, hopes of starting a certain career, are maybe put on the hold, on hold or on the shelf indefinitely, and sometimes never happening. Statistically, that type of couple doesn't have a very good chance of staying together, and so at some point maybe one or the other takes off. And so then you've got the dynamic of a single parent trying to take care of a child, and you know all of the problems incumbent about, you know, in a family like that. So there are consequences to the sin, even though it was forgiven. And what about the man who flies to Miami on business, and while he's down there, he goes and visits his son, who happens to live there, stays a week, flies home that year when he's preparing his income tax. Under his expenses, he lists a trip to Miami and all of the expenses. IRS audits his account, discovers that. So now he's not only paying the extra tax for what he did, along with penalties or interest, but if you blow this up into something that is involving a lot of money, he may be going to jail. And even if he repents, God will forgive him of what he's done. But boy, if you have ever dealt with the IRS, you've got a formidable opponent there, and they're not as forgiving, believe me. So, to conclude, I think it's safe to say that you do know and recognize there are consequences to sins, even though we're forgiven if we repent. And to borrow a phrase from the old TV program, which is popular a number of years ago, Hell Street Blues, at the beginning of each program, the big strapping sergeant with kind of a gruff voice and, you know, just looked like a football player weighing about 300 pounds. He'd give out the assignments to the patrolmen walking the beat and out in the patrol cars. But before he sent them out into the streets of the dangerous city, he'd kind of lean over the podium. He'd look at them and he'd shake his hand at them and say, "You remember, you be careful out there."